Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome to episode 74. Today we examine the emergence of middle management by discussing Alfred Chandler's award-winning book, The Visible Hand, The Managerial Revolution in American Business, published by Belknap Press in 1977. This is part one of the episode where we will present the arguments laid out in the book, which is the history of American commerce from the pre-industrial era to the mid-20th century, and how new technologies and a changing society led to the creation of the modern industrial enterprise. This is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
And this is Jared calling from Sydney in Australia.
This is Leonardo calling from São Paulo, Brazil.
Welcome all, and welcome to another episode of Talking About Organizations, where we're going to cover Alfred Chandler's The Visible Hand, The Managerial Revolution in American Business. This is, I think, we have now established a new record for the longest or largest book that we have covered in a single episode. This one clocks in at 500 pages. It's but it was one heck of a read, I would say. So what'd y'all think?
Yep, I'm holding it right here. This is my library
right,
copy.
Good deal.
It's funny because now it's not a book that I'd read previously, but now that we've been tackling it, I keep seeing it everywhere on people's bookshelves all around the university. So it really is a classic.
Yeah, it is. And it's a Pulitzer Prize winner. I mean, this book came out 1977, and it won the Pulitzer Prize, which is one of the premier literature awards in the United States. And it's usually awarded for those that cover American history or something very significant in American politics and things of that nature. This book, just to kind of give a quick introduction, so then we can sort of frame our discussion of it, because with 500 pages, there is a lot that we could potentially talk about. This really covers about a century and a half of history in terms of how the evolution occurred from the traditional old-fashioned merchant-style business enterprises, where everything was done at a personal level. Everything was small operations, all very pre-industrial. It just basically laid out that as the start. And then talked through in exquisite detail, incredible detail, the construction of industry, and specifically the creation of middle management. And the visible hand is a metaphor that he uses to describe the shift, how middle management emerged as the shift from what he called the invisible hand of the market, which was basically how the market drove everything in commerce and how business was conducted, how it was managed, if managed at all, certainly not managed the way that we think of management. But then over the course of this century and a half, through the Industrial Revolution, the two world wars, etc., we've got back up to the modern industrial enterprise in which the visible hand represents the existence of middle management, which is a very, very real, tangible, visible, present, ubiquitous, painful, everything we love to talk about it, with the existence of middle management in order to control production and distribution and exercising transportation and communication. These were like the four major areas of development during the Industrial Revolution that Chandler walks through. He starts the story with the advent of the railroad, the telegraph, and then the subsequent westward expansion in the United States, following to the rise of large industrial organizations to handle shipping, everything from production to shipping to getting stuff to the customer, and why middle management emerged as a way of having, of basically being allowed to control all of that. That's all quite a mouthful, But I mean, the level of detail was just extraordinary. If you read, you know, if you do take the time to read the entire book, what a history lesson. Incredible. It's still resonates. I mean, it really still does. So, you know, go ahead.
I'm not sure if this is the first history book we've tackled on the podcast, but it is worth kind of highlighting that this is a history book which reveals insights about management rather than the kind of typical more managerial focused texts that we deal with. Reading a little bit about the book, I've read that it's been a defining text in the development of the field of business history itself as well. And yes, Tom, you're right. I mean, there's a great deal of detail in the book, but I think what it does really nicely is it covers the detail at the right amount of depth, I felt. And so you got a sense of, I guess, the historical rigor of Chandler's research, but it wasn't too overwhelming. I mean, it's still quite long. It's 500 pages. I don't think we could have done too many more pages, but I think it's pitched at that right level.
My, just to mention that I didn't have the experience to the weight of the book because I got the Kindle version of it. It helps to you get through the book. The first thing I want to mention, going as Stone said, because it's the kind of book that it's incredible how the idea of the book, it's already on the title of the book. It's interesting how the visible hand he's talking in terms of contrasted with what Adam Smith said, that the idea of the invisible hand, that all the merchants pursuing their interests could allocate resource in a efficient way on market. So it's interesting how he sees the stage of economic development of the United States in this terms. It's very interesting how there are three stages of development. I think maybe Tom could say more about that because I think you saw the big picture. But it's interesting how capitalism came from this kind of putting out system to what Chandler is saying, that's the real revolution, this managerial, this necessity of a growing and expanding market, and how the corporate, I don't know if you can say corporate, but how this multi-business enterprise came out to resolve these problems, and how this is visible. It's not something that it's something who came from nothing, it's something that we can see the development, and there's a lot of history there, and a lot of details to show how this visible hand is coming to life.
So what I could do is talk a little bit about that middle section, just to sort of say, you know, how did he break the history down? I alluded to some of it, but I think it's worth, you know, really kind of talking about some of the types of stories that he tells. Because obviously, you know, what this really is, from a historical standpoint, this is basically, he's grabbing a whole bunch of, histories that were very industry specific, and he melds them together. He sort of draws snippets or draws particular storylines from all of these other histories. You're absolutely right. It was at the right level of detail. You're presented a lot of detail. Enough detail to know that there's a whole bunch of support behind how he lets the story unfold, but he doesn't overwhelm you with detail that isn't essential to what his point is, which is the emergence of the modern industrial enterprise and the middle management that came with it. So just to sort of lay it out, you know, he has one part which is sort of like the beginning of the story, which is how did commerce happen in the pre-industrial period. It was traditional enterprises in commerce and production, which he said, and he said this multiple times in the book, that if you were in 1840 America, you might as well have been in 16th century Florence or something like that, because the kind of system that was established has been around for a very, very long time. So he focuses on primarily the railroad and the telegraph as the enterprises that really, really started to change things, because previously the United States, prior to 1840, was still largely concentrated on the coast, or it was following the waterways. And then the railroads were the thing that basically created all of this expansion. But contrary to somebody who isn't reading it very carefully or is kind of not really understanding the full history of the railroads, You might think that, well, you know, it's great. We built all these railroads and expanded westward, but no, it was a very, very clunky effort. It did not go well. There were all sorts of issues with compatibility of the tracks. Different folks had different ownership of the architecture, etc. So he covers a lot of that in the, you know, for the second half of the 19th century. He then moves in part three to the revolutions in distribution and production. And that's because before, when everything was sort of like at a personal level, where you walk down to the local general store, market, whatever it was, you know, it was all, everybody knew each other and all that. But then as we started getting into mass distribution and mass production, it started to get a lot more impersonal. The attention to the details of how well things were going needed administration of some kind in order to oversee it and coordinate it. And he covers a lot in there. And then ultimately, what he showed in the towards the end is how the modern industrial corporation brought distribution and production together, and it all sort of came together in a way that is especially focused a lot on the mergers, and how mergers, or as these industrial corporations grew, it became a difference between horizontal combination and vertical integration, which we can certainly get into later. That was a really significant step. Now, of course, the book was written in 1977. I think later on in this episode, we could talk about, well, you know, what's happened since. But at least for now, you know, there's so much here we can talk about.
You're right. There's so much to talk about. Something that was interesting to me was how the scale of the growth of the railway kind of system and infrastructure required different types of financing to what was previous in terms of just the amount of money that was required to fund these developments, or the development of these multiple owners and joint stock companies. And the argument that Chandler makes is that necessitated a development of a range of new administrative procedures around bookkeeping, accounting, logistics, and so on. And so that's part of the argument he makes around the development of processes of production and distribution. And that's not something I thought about before. I guess, yeah, in the land of merchants, they were able to fund most of their activities themselves without having to pool together large sums of money with other financiers.
Yeah, and it's interesting just how that process wasn't automatic. I mean, for quite some time, he tells numerous stories about how, you know, as these enterprises grew and changed, cost accounting did not exist. And so we went through periods of time where there wasn't really an accounting for just, you know, how to tell whether or not the operation is profitable, but there wasn't even interest in going there. There was a whole gap. I mean, it's fascinating, really.
Yeah, it's really interesting, this part, I thought, because it's a level of detail that brought to us many consequences to what would become the idea of accounting, and more, something that he says that this kind of new enterprise brought to the economy and a certain level of, not level, but it could provide the company to think about the future. It's very interesting because he said that these new forms of data coming into the organization could make planning more. And so the planning was not a revolution, I think, but something that really changed how the organization would operate. So, and it's interesting how he can show you when this happened and how. Some accounting revolution. This is something that I didn't expect, and it was very interesting to know that maybe for us it's kind of simple or obvious, but how this thing developed and changed all the way business were done by the time.
Yeah, and that you bring up a point that, I mean, cost accounting nowadays is so everywhere. I mean, we couldn't imagine a world without it. But yeah, we kind of have to understand its beginnings, I think, because when we think about how, you know, looking at this from, say, a change lens, you know, how did change occur? How did organizations develop, transform? That's the sort of thing, you know, that in a very, very short amount of time, really, we saw this evolution take place of going from no-cost accounting to accounting. You know, since he did talk about the railroads and the telegraphs as sort of like the way of springboarding this, to me, a very interesting part of it in the early part of the book was the impact of the telegraph. Obviously, railroads were significant just because now you could traverse across land in places reliably that was not possible. But even then, coordination, I mean, I remember back to, what was it? I forget how long ago it was. It was like the very beginning of the pandemic when we did the episode on the Hudson's Bay Company. And that was one where, you know, you want to talk about coordination, you know, so you have a ship that takes the annual letter from the Hudson's Bay all the way back to London. The telegraph, you know, it wasn't actually clear to me from the book exactly, you know, apart from we could build the telegraphs, therefore we did. It wasn't really clear that there was necessarily a purpose to it, you know, a specific purpose to it, aside from just generally to provide communication. And then once that was there and people started to realize, hey, we could coordinate things by telegraph this way, it really, really changed the way that enterprises were able to operate, especially because we're talking about the same, you know, really long distances from where, you know, the shop was to where the market was, and how do we ensure that everything gets there?
Yes, it's a good point, Tom. Yeah, to come back to the book's argument around the emergence of this middle level of management in organizations, I mean, there's no need, well, the value of a middle manager who can't communicate both up and down the line in a efficient way, that goes to the heart of the emergence of that role. And I also thought of when reading the book back to the Hudson Bay episode, because yeah, what good is a middle manager if it takes them a year to get the message from upper management to the front line? And so this comes to the point of actually at the beginning of the book, Chandler lays out some general propositions which are quite useful at guiding your thinking throughout the book. And the third one, he argues that the emergence of kind of well, middle managers or administration became more efficient and more profitable than the market coordination. And so that efficiency wouldn't have been possible without the accompanying development, as you say, Tom, of the emergence of the telegraph system. And so really, they go hand in hand. It would be interesting to imagine a world without the telegraph accompanying the railway. I imagine it would have been much more like a Hudson Bay type of, I guess, story if that was the case.
Yeah, well, in a way, I think that's what it looked like initially because, I mean, it's not, you know, again, it isn't like this happened very quickly. In essence, what you saw for quite some time, just like with cost accounting, Chandler showed how, you know, for the longest time, people just didn't change their minds over what was important, which included just overlooking, not really caring about how, you know, costs were generated or depreciation or any of that. In a similar fashion, what the initial owners seemed to do once the telegraph was in and once they were able to coordinate better, they were still kind of coordinating the same sort of ways that they did as though it were in person. There wasn't really, you know, there was no thought about delegating or what have you. And if anything, the telegraph brought on initially a lot of tougher competition as the different railroads, different subnetworks, and in some cases, different redundant networks started competing with each other for control of different territories and all of that sort of thing. It's like taking the same, very, very merchant, very market-oriented economy and just applying it to a broader scale.
I thought that I misunderstood, but I read some critics and I think that, oh, this is something interesting because I was thinking that this new type of company, this new enterprise that Chandler said, it's a response, an answer to the telegraph. I mean, of course, because if there wasn't the telegraph, we couldn't coordinate things from distance and we couldn't have this reduction of information costs, something like that. But on the other hand, he said that this expanding market of United States was not accomplished by this kind of specialization that he said. You couldn't have many small companies, small business all along the United States. It was a kind of necessity to have this kind of velocity in throughput that he said. It's important that goods have a constant flow and you cannot stop this. And I got thinking a kind of egg and who came first? You know, what's the...
The chicken or the egg, that kind of a thing?
Chicken or the egg kind of thing.
That is a very, very good point. And I think we don't necessarily have to worry so much about the, you know, philosophical arguments like that. The criticisms, of course, are going to... If you write a book, you will be criticized. Yeah, that's just a given. But it is interesting, though, to see how coordination itself evolved, you know, how a lot of things did evolve that ultimately led to the industrial enterprise, just out of, you know, a long series of a growth of emerging problems. You know, every time that there was a problem, there was a solution. So in the railroads, you had the problem of coordinating when stuff would arrive. Once Americans started realizing that you could reliably ship stuff long distances, then you had a coordination issue of connecting where the stuff was made to the marketplace forward. And without the coordination, you would end up with, it would be just like the old days where boats would just pile up or, you know, somewhere on the shore or whatever. And if a boat shows up at the factory, then you load it and off it goes. The factory is just sitting there generating stuff, hoping that the next boat comes sometime before they start stockpiling or what have you. And the same thing was happening with the railroads. The same thing was happening with the railroads because a system had not been in place. And it took quite a while, and different players had to come to grips with this idea that, you know what, we can't have factories just spitting out stuff. There's nowhere to ship it at any given time. And the demand for use of the railroad for shipping goods was exceeding the railroads. So there had to be ways of trying to get schedule, you know, you had a problem of scheduling. We had to resolve the schedule. And all of that became possible because of the telegraph and also because of the different ways in which the railroad operators were starting to evolve their thinking about how you manage a railroad. And I think it's interesting, you know, he also, although he didn't make this a centerpiece, he also made a very, very important point in several parts of the book talking about the professionalism of the railroad industry, where, you know, if you had best practices or something like that, well, we create trade journals. We created means of being able to spread the word to others. And that helped with developing these systems of coordination that became useful, that became shared. You know, all of the things that we say nowadays are really important. They were starting that in this process in the late 1800s.
Oh, you mentioned that professionalism. This is something very interesting because he uses all the framework, could say that, of a kind of sociology of professions, because it's interesting how they stress the importance of journals, business associations to form this kind of middle management mentality and something that they could share and they could share experience and information and then grow as a class. I don't know, really, like a new, he says, a new economic person, new economic man, something like that. So it's very interesting how he used this in terms of something, a central, not a central in analysis, but something that he says, oh, this is very important, how this middle management get together and talk about their business.
Yeah, the middle managers become increasingly professional and increasingly technical. They become, I guess, experts. And their expertise lies in their administrative skills and knowledge relating to, I guess, railways and, to a lesser extent, the telegraph system. They don't add value by understanding how to lay railway tracks, and they don't add value like an owner in terms of the capital they bring. Their value comes through that coordination role that they play. There's so many things in the book where Chandler traces the emergence of a set of practices or routines from different, I guess from the original technology. And then the one here that you're mentioning is around the development of expert knowledge and how that is captured in trade journals and even later on, I think, you know, he moves into business schools.
Well, we can talk about the business schools here because it's, you know, the origins of it are part of the book. I mean, it is part of one of the foundational things of the professionalism of management. And it especially, I think, really helped to sort of codify in a way or start to begin the process of separating ownership from middle management. Because that was one of the things that I thought was really striking over time, how you saw owners who were, you know, the concept of ownership was very, very hands-on, very personal. As these enterprises grew, then, you know, and as you started to see more and more power, authority, however you want to put it, shifting to this middle layer of management, most owners, certainly the successful ones that Chandler focused on, seemed to eventually elevate themselves up to sort of more of an executive slash strategic view, which kind of makes sense because towards the end, the time covered in the end of the book is right around the time when Chester Bernard wrote The Functions of the Executive. And when you started to see a little bit more of a thought put into what is an executive's role, which is to say, you know, what they do and what is left to the middle layer. That all kind of, that was all part of the latter part of the book when we started seeing how the industrial enterprise had matured and we started to see a little bit more stabilization in terms of delineations of responsibilities and all that. And also, you know, what constituted proper credentialing. Because obviously with ownership, there was no credential except for you were the one with the money, really.
Yeah, because we are talking this maybe this the same time span from Taylor. So it's interesting how I think he distinguished this kind of thing of the this kind of management from the scientific management. I don't know what he says, some kind of tensions between the management and the long planning of the management, of the middle management, the idea of you have to think of this business through many years and that kind of first-hand and tasks and all the things that you have more in the or in the order of the day. It's interesting how he shows the importance of this kind of step away from day-to-day operations to think how we will run this business in terms of this market is interest, that no, it's not, how we will approach this industry and so on. So all the knowledge that we'll be creating about this kind of activities.
Yeah, he actually does devote a little bit of time to Taylor at a couple of different parts in the book. It was kind of fascinating because you sort of looking at it from the other side, you know, because of course, what we did covered Taylor before, it's been largely from the scientific management perspective of saying here, I've got a solution to a problem. On the other side, the timing was such that here it is that they're recognizing a more general problem about we have to be able to account for costs and to be able to align resources to production. And how do we not just account for the cost, but also make things more efficient? And voila, it's the same time that Taylor comes into the picture, and you know, the rest is the rest is history, I guess.
On this, is it right that the profitability of the industry was really connected to the scale? I think that's what I read. So the profitability came from the scale rather than high margins. And that's what drove the need for these sort of efficiencies. That and the fact that they had a pool of investors who wanted to see some return on their money. And so they needed to make sure basically they were getting the most out of their dollar. And yeah, so to eliminate, I guess, waste. I mean, was this the beginning of the obsession with efficiency?
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement, and indeed, this is one of the things that I took away from it as well, is that once we switched over to conceptions of mass production, mass distribution, you're absolutely right. I mean, it was the idea of the mass commerce meant that you had to make sure that the movement of stuff from the factory to the consumer was as reliable as possible and as efficient as possible. You know, more, it was about quantity, not necessarily quality. And so, you know, it was interesting to think about the way that he compared or discussed some of the different industries, particularly the difference between those that were truly mass. Like he spent a lot of time talking about textiles, clothing, rubber goods. He had quite a bit of stories about various of these types of industries as they emerged. Tobacco was another one he spent a lot of time on, about how a lot of them, once you move from, say, with tobacco, he talked about how moving from the cigar, which was, you know, a very, very laborious, high-end type of an activity, to the development of cigarettes, which, it was astounding. I forget the number. It was like 20 million a week, something like that, being, you know, the factories were spitting out that many cigarettes. It's hard to think now because not so many people smoke nowadays. You know, just to be able to put those together, you know, now your margins are really built on how many of these cigarettes, you know, you get the cigarettes out there so that the supply sort of creates the demand. And then it's all about how many of them can you actually sell. And then it's probably like fractions of a fraction of a penny for each cigarette sold, as opposed to a high-end cigar. But the quantity makes up for that. As long as everything in the from factory to consumer is smooth and operating the way that it's supposed to be. Stability, reliability, and predictability would be kind of the qualities I'd associate with that.
Yes, and the growth was also being driven in part by the growing population. Yeah, growing population, which obviously was driving the need to build more houses, more infrastructure. So really it was a, I don't know if I can say this, a virtuous cycle of growth, which this was all piggybacking on.
Yeah, and that's actually one of the points he made in towards the conclusion is that, you know, like when you compare how the United States grew, because, you know, he sort of summarizes it at the end about how the United States became the seedbed. He called it the seedbed of managerial capitalism. And it was largely the conditions of the states at the time that this westward expansion, this growth was possible. Unlike, say, Europe, because he did, it was very interesting. He did kind of compare it to Europe, because Europe didn't have this massive untamed wilderness. Europe industrialized, and they followed along with a lot of the same things that came out from the States, but they didn't realize the same type of growth simply because their lands were already pretty much spoken for. Instead, they were expanding their horizons to, you know, colonializing around this time. So it was kind of different.
And Europe didn't have the scale for the size of the market is not that great. I think he is not that large, sorry. He made some points like that because you have this kind of point of time that United States, you have the perfect conditions for this kind of business to flourish. All the movements that came along with that is interest to say about how the companies start to integrate and how they start to absorb some kind of costs inside them, and then it starts the growing of the organizational chart, let's say like this. So I think it's interesting how he said about the opportunities of that technology brought to this expansion. Like, for example, all the horizontal, like you said at the beginning, Tom, the horizontal integration, and then the vertical integration, how this movement happens in some industry, not in others. And this is interesting because when you have this large gains of scale, where you have that idea of quantity, so this is where the things happen. This didn't happen in Europe.
That's a good point, because I casually mentioned it before, but it really bears out that when he talked about the history of the development or the creation of these modern industrial enterprises, he really contrasted the industries where you saw more what he called horizontal combination, which was essentially just merger of peer organizations, largely to try to capture or dominate a very specific industry, that those were not nearly as successful as those that were vertically integrated, which is to say that the enterprise takes over, accumulates, however you want to put it, the whole supply chain from raw material to delivery to the consumer. And this is sort of like where, you know, from when I was growing up, you know, although when I was young, I didn't know what vertical integration was. But what I, you know, certainly became accustomed to was the idea of that if I went to a car company, like a General Motors a car salesman, what I saw from GM, you know, the GM cars, they were created, designed, the supplies assembled from, all of the, you know, everything done was, you know, had a GM signature on it. It was cradle to grave, all by the corporation. And so then it was around the time, like ironically, around the time that this book was published, when vertical integration, started to become less of a thing, shall we say. So we can certainly dive into that in part two, but certainly from the perspective of the evolution of the industrial enterprise, the advantages of vertical integration were very, very plain and evident, and certainly contributed to the need for this dedicated set of managers who could coordinate across all these different steps of the process in things where nobody had expertise in everything. And it was, you had to have that oversight, the coordination. Go ahead.
And this is very important to how these companies grow competences and qualifications and, you know, how they say today, capabilities, because they have to think all the way through the chain. Imagine that their staff thinking how to improve the results, how to change markets, and also how to innovate, how to create new products, how we can change things in this industry. So it's interesting how he points the importance of these people coming together, all the thinking in this new form of business. And today we are thinking whole way different of this and how this skill could be transferred. Because it's interesting when he said that by the World War II, how this was important to coordinate things, to create goods for the war, and how the government uses this competencies, this flowing of goods should just change the direction for another goal. So
yeah, a very good point there too, because that's one other thing about the latter part of the book that he covered that I think is interesting too, is that the government becoming a major consumer. That happened in the United States during the World Wars when we saw that massive ramp up, you know, for mobilization for both of the wars, and the effect that it had. Because you know, unlike the individual consumer or another like businesses buying machinery or things like that, the government can definitely choose what it wants to purchase. It can do so kind of, I wouldn't say on a whim, but it's certainly a market that fluctuates, or a demand that fluctuates, I should say. And he covered that in the book. It was really fascinating to see how. In a lot of ways that there was depression when there was, he noted like a whole string of recessions that occurred over the course of several decades. And then when the government came in, that it changed some of the stability of commerce during those periods.
I think some of the beauty of the book is how it moves between kind of macro, meso, micro, and how these technological developments, as Chandler argues, shape the development of an industry, which shapes the development of a range of practices, organizational structures, and then how that flows through and even sees the emergence of a new form of manager, a new way of interacting within organizations. I mean, you can probably even link it to the growth of the middle class and so on. So it really kind of moves across these different levels. But I mean, one of the criticisms of the book is that it is technologically determinant and accepts the technology as from a neutral perspective and doesn't question, you know, perhaps the perverse effects that it had on society. Or and we've said it a few times, I think in some ways Chandler published at just the right time because things started changing, you know, around the late 1970s, and people started to question, okay, maybe these technologies, we should look a little bit more carefully into how they affect people's lives, or what are the unintended consequences, or who is responsible for the development of some of these technologies, and what motivations they might have.
Here's how I'd like to handle that, because I think that is a good that's a good cue for part two. But I think there's one more point that I think we should raise about the book itself, which I think partly addresses that criticism. Because if there's one thing about the book that I found really useful, is also thinking about how particular legal actions or legal frameworks enabled a lot of what was going on, in particular the Sherman Antitrust Act. One of the things that happened was that the governments early on in this process, like in the 1880s, around that time, the act was in 1890, broke apart. You know, were basically used to break apart large monopolistic firms. So if a firm was becoming monopolistic, it was potentially going to be impacted by this antitrust act, and it prevented the creation of huge monolithic monopolistic types of sub entities. That's not to say that there were some very, very large enterprises that happened. But I think that what that did was that it fostered a certain degree of competition that Chandler highlighted throughout. And I think that when we think about, say, going to the present time, which we'll do in part two, those laws that were established back then in order to solve particular problems are now being used, you know, have been used ever since. And I think actually he had mentioned at the end the breakup of American Telephone and Telegraph. I think it was in the tail end of the book. It was one of my one of the first major business events, if you will, that I can remember from my youth was the breakup of AT&T.
Yeah, I think it is something that caught my attention as well in the book. Is, I mean, the whole premise of his argument is that the large modern enterprise, as he describes it, became more efficient and more profitable than market coordination. But it got me thinking, well, we kind of question that now, because we know all about the distorting effects that large enterprises can have on markets. And so it almost seemed a counterintuitive claim to me that a really, really big organization might be more efficient in coordinating commerce. So, yeah, and I think probably we can jump into that in more detail in part two.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback. So if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Finally, we would like to thank some wonderful people for supporting the show. Sarah Audner, Leon Prieto, Hadi Shaheen, Marshall Reiner, Alice Barbosa, Thomas Roulet, Heiko Schmidt, Barton Friedland, Guldem Kara Mustafa, Roberto Bernardi, Marina Timmer, Bernard Hogan, Eddie Hunsinger, Fiona Knight, Peaks Craft, Timothy Paul, Willy Leidon-Wirte, Gabriel Van Bunnen, and Clara Lux. It's easy to support the show, and all you have to do is go to our website, where a donations button will greet you. Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.